Welcome to Bagel Tech Big, the weekend show from the Bagel Tech Network with me, Ewan Rankin. And I'm joined, as always, by the Fantastic Four who've joined us from the wilds of Luton, the fantastic windswept heaths of Essex, the Philippines, and San Francisco. I don't know what the weather's like there, so we'll have to see. It's a melting pot.
Well, truly worldwide.
Joining us top left, we've got... I am so seriously pissed off with Boinks at the moment.
Yay.
Boinks is a turd rolled in glitter. And I know I've started...
I'm surprised you gave the glitter... And on Boinks.
It's turd rolled in glitter with a sparkler. There we go. Right. Sorry about that. I'll edit that bit, don't worry. No, I won't. Top left, we've got Mr. James Hart at Syzygy on Twitter. How are you doing, mate?
Very good. I'm not used to being top left, first in the line for telling you how I am. And, yes, are you well?
I'm good, mate. I'm good. First full week back at work, I think, isn't it?
Yes. Been an absolute nightmare.
Absolutely knackered.
One of the last days in March means that everybody wants to spend their budgets and wants to get things installed. And we're just going to have to go, you sure you can't save it? So we'll get there, though. We'll get there.
Give them a rollover.
Yeah, rollover. That's
rollover,
right.
That's what the it money needs. Next budget time. Needs a rollover. Have you had a good week or just a busy one? Flat out.
Very absolutely flat out. I'm going to sleep well tonight and probably not get up until Tuesday.
I was less than 2 miles from where you were on Thursday, and we couldn't even have time to get a beer after work. So
absolutely, we could have run up the Westway towards each other, couldn't we?
Bad dude, arms akimbo.
Yeah.
With Heathcliff and Kathy playing in the background.
Absolutely, with the speed limit only being 30 miles an hour, no, everyone would have seen it.
Well, I had the pleasure of driving in under the Hanger Lane Directory, and there was a bus broken in the underpass, which, as you can imagine, means that it took me 2.5 hours to do 4 miles. So, God, I love London. Talking of London, our Essex girl, in the nicest possible way.
Now.
Sarah Jane, on an improvised toilet brush microphone. Because her studio's been ripped to shreds. How are you doing, Mrs.?
I'm doing very well.
You've had 2 weeks off, so I expect a superlative performance. What's been happening in the world of web?
It's been a busy week, and I can now talk about the fact that the last few months I've been learning all about SharePoint.
SharePoint's awesome. I like SharePoint.
Yeah, for various reasons, I couldn't talk about it before, but now again, so getting to grips with that's my project at work and will be my life for the next 4 weeks until the new site's up and running.
Well, I fully understand why anyone would want to talk about a Microsoft product. However, it is very functional. It's very useful. So I think it's my thumbs up. Below her, we've got Mr. Kyle Swagger. Hello, mate.
Hello.
90 degrees in the shade, no doubt, where you are at the moment. It's only 6 a.m.
Pretty much. Actually, I think it's 86 degrees right now.
Rightio. The third show of the day, but you've got to kit, whereas I haven't. And finally, the man who has got plenty of time in bed, Mr. Eric Lanigan.
Hey, guys. Hey, Ewan.
Hello, mate. Now, San Francisco, struggling with the potential on-draft of nuclear fallout from Japan.
Yes, best case scenario, we develop some kind of superpowers akin to Marvel Comics, but worst case scenario, we get thyroid cancer. So here's keeping our fingers crossed, it's the first.
The thing that you got in your favor is that the total death toll from Chernobyl so far is 40. So based on the fact there's a 3,000-mile gap between you and Japan, I think you're fairly safe. Just don't get bitten by the spider.
Yes, stay away from those radioactive spiders.
Stay away from the spiders. There we go.
If anybody should be afraid, it should be me.
Yeah, exactly. You're closer.
You're a lot nearer.
Yeah, but
wind's blowing the other way.
We're not worried.
You do have a bit of a green glow to you.
No, it's just my monitor calibration.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. The week in technology. What a bad week it's been, because everyone's been waiting for the iPad 2, of course, which came out today here in the UK. We've had AT&T have kind of bought, I'm not sure if it's absolutely certain yet, but they kind of bought the T-Mobile business in the US for $39 billion. That figure's fluctuated a little bit, and it hasn't lost anything in the conversion from pounds to dollars and dollars to pounds and back again. Microsoft have bought 666,000 IP addresses. We were talking before the start. There's just way too many sixes in there to not cast Steve Ballmer as the Antichrist. RIM has got ability to run Android applications. We'll talk about that one in a second for sure. OMG, FYI, LOL, and Roffle are all in the Oxford English Dictionary now, which is an absolute... Don't get me started. And last, but by no means least, the Wii may rule the living room, but the Xbox 360 rules the bedroom. There's obviously a Kinect hack there that I've missed. But we'll have to... If anyone's seen that and finds the story on it, the Kinect in the bedroom, that's got... no, let's not go there. It's a clean podcast.
Yeah.
Okay. Back to the start then. So let's start with the RIM playbook thing, because that's kind of the freshest story on the block. RIM is suggesting that Android apps can be run within the playbook as an option. And we were just sitting before we started there talking about it, and it, the debate seems to be whether it's running it natively or whether it's something that's a bit more difficult to do, a bit more techie. It's not going to be the, for the average consumer. What have we got so far on this? Is this, you're saying it's Java in what you said earlier on, Eric?
Yeah, it's going to be, they've announced in a little press release yesterday, so I'm actually kind of new to the story and trying to catch up on it myself.
Sure.
It appears that they've announced two new, they've already got like five different application development layers. They now have two more. They've got Android app player, application player, and they've got BlackBerry Java. Now, what I'm not clear on yet from reading is why anyone would write for BlackBerry Java and how that differs from the Android one. But it seems that for the Android one, you have to, first of all, it can only be up to Gingerbread compatible apps. It can't be written for Honeycomb specifically. And those apps, you can't just download them from like any old Android marketplace or Android app store. They have to be submitted, repackaged slightly for this playbook compatibility, and then approved by BlackBerry. So it's very, it seems to be, it's strange.
I mean, stepping back from the technical element of this and looking at it more from a global perspective, what we've actually got here then is we're saying that everyone was scoffing because iPad has got the wealth of benefit within iPad is the applications, and everyone was kind of scoffing because the playbook is going to emerge with virtually nothing. But now the playbook's emerging with potentially 200,000 available applications instantly, you know. So coming back from the technical element, does this just kind of, is this a hammer blow in terms of the marketability of the playbook?
But that number that you just quoted, was that based on the number of Android applications that are currently on the market?
Yeah,
well, see, that's the thing. It sounds like all those apps would have to be rebundled. So you have to modify them in some way and then distribute them through BlackBerry. So it wouldn't have anywhere near that many out of the gate. I'll let you finish what you were saying. But yeah, it sounds like they won't have immediate access to the full library of Android apps by any means.
I mean, one of the discussion points I thought was quite useful for tonight was the fact that we've got the iPad 2 coming here in the UK today. Everyone's looking around at what's the competition for the iPad, and people have gone, oh, it's the Galaxy S tablet, 7-inch, and blah, blah, blah. All right. No, it's not. The 10-inch, well, no, it's the 10-inch then. Well, you're going to take a bit of convincing. Then they said it's the Zoom, and the Zoom's gone up against the iPad 2 in a test, and it's got absolutely hammered. And the only one that really seems to have got some of the critics with any kind of credibility associated with it has been the BlackBerry playbook. A lot of people are saying, well, you know, it's been well thought out. They've gone for the intermediate market. They've thought about what Apple is not going to do and filled that 7-inch tablet market. And they've actually done it quite well. The people that have seen it and played with it have said that it's good. However, the one thing that's been holding it back is that, you know, where's the killer blow? The killer blow is apps. The killer blow is not functionality. It's not processor. It's not storage. It's not, RAM. It's apps. And does this potentially give them a little bit more armor to kind of strike into the market at a higher level than we previously would have given them credit for.
If they can
Say again, Sarah.
I think it's Rim actually hedging their bets, and I can't blame them. You know, with the number of Apple iPhone apps and the number of apps for Android, why wouldn't any other player actually, you know, minimize their risk and allow them, you know, open up their market to another option?
James, your point?
I was going to say that if they can put it off right, you know, if somebody obviously was sitting around the boardroom table and said, I've got this brilliant idea, Android's open. If we can get something which is kind of like a shim for the BlackBerry, because I did an American accent, I'm not going to do that, a shim for BlackBerry that will play Android apps, we could make an absolute fortune on it if we focus all the revenue through our store. Of course, BlackBerry is totally in the proprietary realm. And unless they get it right, they're not going to be able to appeal to the developers to report their software. They're not going to get the right revenue model to satisfy everybody. And you'll end up with a small dribble of applications turning up on the BlackBerry and everyone just goes, what the heck was that fuss all about?
Yeah, I mean, this is a bit of a gamble, you're saying.
It's a gamble, and I don't know if Rim can pull it off because they're not used to getting stuff from outside them. You know, they have been their own ecosystem right the way up till now.
People seem to like people like the BlackBerry name. People trust the name in business because it means super secure and the ability for IT administrators to lock it down and secure it and modify it as they see fit. So the entrance then of if I'm reading this right, they now have five separate application development platforms for this device, whereas Apple has, for instance, one, you know, and that's not counting HTML5 and the in-browser stuff itself on either of those devices. So it's possible best case scenario here, they get more apps than they would have if they only had their own native API, because few people would write for just that tablet.
Mm-hmm.
Middle scenario would be that they end up having the least attractive platform because no one writes native apps. So all the apps run extra slowly or in some kind of emulation layer or don't resemble the native interface that the critics loved at CES. And the worst case scenario would be that the businesses that they're trying to attract don't even like it because they find security risks or some kind of, you know, problems of having every popular application running in some kind of virtualized and slower and maybe less secure environment.
And another worst case scenario is that it gets about 30 minutes of battery life. I mean, how much crap is running on this thing? I mean, you got HTML5, you got Flash, you've got Air support, we've got Android. It's like they've just thrown everything in but the kitchen sink on this thing. I'm still not convinced with the playbook. I feel that BlackBerry's been dragging their feet since last year. And it's obvious that's where it's at. They know they don't have the apps for it, so they have turned to Android for that to fill that void, shall we say.
So is this a Hail Mary?
I think so. I'm not convinced with this thing. I just don't think it's going to do good. I think a 7-inch is on its way out. I think the Samsung Galaxy proved that. I think people are used to a 10-inch tablet. Apple apparently still is doing it the right way. And I know the Zoom has gotten a bit of criticism this week, and it's well due, but I still feel when it comes to processing power, when you put it up against the iPad, I still feel the Zoom way outperforms the BlackBerry playbook. I mean, we've barely seen this thing yet in action. I really do. I feel it's a last-ditch effort from BlackBerry to say, hey, look, we've got something, too. We've thrown the refrigerator, the kitchen sink, and everything at it. So we've got you covered.
You're talking about the launch of a tablet that's a month away, and they're already throwing Hail Mary passes here to try and get the damn thing to work and function at all anyway.
Well, their availability here in this article says available this summer. No, I'm sorry. No, that says the app players will be this summer. But before you go again, I just wanted to say, you were talking about how the critics loved and praised the playbook and said this might be the best contender against the iPad.
Yeah.
Well, what they loved about it, I mean, it's got the same hardware as all these tablets are the same hardware, the same form factor. They're just a rectangular slab of glass, you know. The thing that differentiated it was the attractive user interface. Well, you're not going to have that user interface and that experience that's so beloved if you've got Android apps, Air apps, Flash apps, all these non-native apps with their own user interfaces running slowly and with their own idiosyncrasies on top of what, however good BlackBerry's native UI is.
It's like a patchwork quilt.
Well, you know, like I said, they've got all that credibility. They've got all that kudos from the people that are saying maybe BlackBerry is the competition for Apple iPad. Could they just have thrown it all completely out the window in the last 24 hours? All of that potential kudos that goes with the way that they've developed it, with the fact that they've held back, with the fact that they've got good hardware specs that are going to come out and hit the market at a good level, has all that just been thrown out the window by this desperation of dragging in as many possible apps as they possibly can from the Android market?
Well, the only thing Apple would have to do to completely knock them out of the game is do something that would really, really cater to large-scale enterprise who needs to be able to have super, super secure email and super secure communication and the ability to lock down and restrict features from a distance and control how their users, you know, in high-security environments use it. If Apple just did that to the iPad, game over.
Mm.
Absolutely, because this is completely the opposite direction to that.
So, where does this sit with the webOS thing? I mean, webOS has just released its SDK to anyone and everyone that fancies a play with it. They're clearly desperate for applications, but they're saying you've got to develop within our OS. We're not going to take anything else and port it across. We're not looking for a substandard user experience. We want it to be webOS. Anyone can have a go, but it's got to be webOS. A BlackBerry diminishing the user experience here potentially as well, because I mean, if this is all running through Java, which is what we seem to be seeing, then there's vulnerabilities associated with Java, significant vulnerabilities associated with porting stuff backwards and forwards, and there's going to be significant issues and crashing as well as the user experience is going to be significantly poorer as well as, surely.
Battery life also, every time you have to abstract some layer of computation like that. Yeah, it could be bad.
I think
this is seven inches.
Go ahead, Sarah.
I think this is the downside of we've got maybe four different players with four different OSs. We're not talking about hardware that's up to the spec that of a serious PC, yeah. So it can't handle things like virtual machines and emulators particularly well, like Eric was saying. And the only way you're going to avoid this happen if you want the vendors to actually spread their options, particularly with RIM and HP, with WebOS, is for them to, you know, basically for the market to converge and we end up with Android versus Apple.
Anyone come back on that?
I don't know if it's going to be Android versus Apple. Android's all over the damn place still with me right now. I wish they would get their act together. I mean, right now we're even seeing Google this week saying that they don't really want to let 3.0 out because they don't want people sticking it on smartphones. It's purely for a tablet thing, so they're kind of restricting that already.
Yeah, the business model converges it.
But the thing is, Kyle, I actually think that apps are key here. The number of apps is key. You can have the greatest OS and everything to run on the platform, but if you haven't got the apps, that's what's been killing WebOS, is the fact that vendors wouldn't actually develop for it.
It is the apps, but you've got to have stability too. I mean, you look at if this is the prime example of it. BlackBerry, fine, I've got access to the Android market, but it runs like crap. Or I've got 20 minutes of battery left to play my favorite Android game. There has to be a middle there, and I don't believe anybody's found it yet. The only one that's got it right now is the Wall of Garden Apple. Now, we need somebody else to come to the market. WebOS, I think, is great, but the problem is you've got to go over and develop for something else. But part of me wants to say that if they did it for Android and they'd done it for Apple, then why not WebOS?
Question
why not give it a chance?
I agree. I'd love to see that succeed, Kyle.
Wear OS is something that really excites me. I've said before, you know, I'm really salivating over the potential of what that offers, but whether it realises it is a different question entirely. Max S in the chat room is saying, quality of applications, question mark. Now, within that statement, you've got to think whether the applications, there's fantastic figures talked about the number of applications that there are in the Apple marketplace, how many flashlight applications, fart applications, syncing task applications. There's been three syncing task applications come out this week, and not one of them can do what the iPad really needs, which is a complete overhaul of mail, a complete overhaul of calendar, and a complete overhaul of address functionality. None of them can address that.
Choice of web browser or something.
Safari sucks. Well, at least the web browser thing is there, though. At least Apple are letting web browsers through. But there is nothing coming through that actually deals with the fundamental functionality of a tablet, which is, I want to send mail, I want to talk to people, I want to know where I'm going and when I'm doing it.
Yeah, that's and there you go. There's a major failure of the, at least for a lot of users, of the closed Apple-controlled ecosystem. One of the most popular applications, the most necessary, are totally controlled by Apple, and they will not let apps into their store that compete on functionality.
There you go. 500,000 applications, most of which are how straight I can pee into a toilet bowl.
Well, at least it teaches us that. makes the females happy.
That's just for the females. What are you talking about?
steady.
This is going back to things that we talk about in the photo show as well, is that the sellability of anything is in the numbers that you can produce in your advertising. And Apple stand there and say X quantity, X zero zeros of applications, but there is no qualitative value within that figure whatsoever. You look at Android does the same thing, and it says, oh, we've got 200,000 apps now, so we're getting comparable with, and most of them are free, absolutely fantastic, but one tells you how much battery life you got left. You know, and there's another 20,000 of them out there that tells you how much battery life you've got left, and it's free.
And when you let Apple close down the things like storefronts, when they control not just the hardware, the operating system, the apps that go through, but the storefronts themselves, you get problems like that where it can be hard to find, hard to separate the good applications from the bad.
Is this something that RIM is going to be able to manage with the playbook then? Is this a USP they're going to be able to manage? Are they going to only allow porting of decent applications to their store? Is this something that they've got up their sleeve, which they haven't yet managed to announce yet?
In their
case, that'd be cool. Because if they don't.
Say again, Sarah.
I was going to say it's apps that they deem in their judgment to be okay that are on the Android market.
And your
point. I remember.
The point I'm making there like, is it's the same.
Go ahead, Sarah.
It's the same as the App Store app.
If it sounded like I was going to say something more a few seconds ago and then just stopped abruptly, I had lost my train of thought, but I just remembered what I was going to say. When they control the storefront, you get also what they did with podcasts. I've been thinking about this, how everyone thought it was the most terrific thing in the world when iTunes, what was it? It was like version 4.9 or something way back when, started supporting native downloading and loading onto your iPod of podcasts based on RSS feeds. It was simultaneously the best and worst thing that happened to podcasting, because while it opened it up and made it so much easier, it completely closed off innovation to the point where it's almost impossible for a mass. It is impossible for a mass audience to use a non iTunes podcatching client. I would have to think like 99% of people who listen to podcasts do it subscribe through iTunes and sync that way exclusively. And the result is it's so much harder to find and sort and view your podcast than it is the content that Apple is selling in their adjacent for sale for profit store. And that is, we have them to blame for that.
I mean, one of the interesting things there to lead on from that point is the fact that if you look at the Mac App Store, as far as the Mac hard, you know, the desktop and netbook platforms concerned, trying to find an application to do something that you want is impossible. You cannot go into that front end with an ideology of this is what I want to find something to do for me, and actually find something that does that. The only way to get anything from that app store is to go in with the name of the application that you want.
Yeah, or just browse like a SkyMall catalog or something.
No, I just don't think you get it, Eric. I'm sorry, I've gone in and I've looked for things that do specific needs for me, and I can't find anything that does it. I've
so gone it's word to, of mouth that matters, really.
Yeah, I've gone to Twitter and said, I want to do this. I want to go to Twitter and I say, I want to do this. Anyone got any ideas? And someone says, duh, it's right in front of you in the Mac App Store. It's called X. And I go in and type in X and go, oh, yeah. Well, actually, I spent the last 2 hours looking for this free application in there, and I couldn't find it at all.
Right, and I agree. It's because they've closed off any kind of innovation in the searchability of those applications. If they just want to give you that simple search bar and whatever kind of light categorization that they do, you're stuck with that, and then you have to go to the World Wide Web to figure out, you know, like you said, solutions to individual problems.
There's a point here in the chat room coming through. Categories? Question mark. Categories does not cut it. Categories is lightweight in terms of actually understanding what you can find. If you go to let's say something that's as big and as obvious as Call of Duty 4, something, you know, a shoot 'em up game. Where's shoot 'em up in categories?
Right.
Yeah, I think as much as anything, it's the fact that the App Store, I think the App Store platform in itself is quite embryonic. The recommendations, the fact that you review it, I mean, every iPhone app that I've ever sort of switched off said, would you like to rate this app before you close it? And you'll either give it 1 to 5. But actually, that means nothing in the grand scheme of things, because there must be so many applications that people are rating 1, but still come to the surface.
There's a certain element, I think, from looking at our own performance with iTunes, that is centered around the number of reviews that you have. So if you look at the qualitative score that you get to boost your application or to boost your podcast in the way that it's presented to people, the episodes and the podcasts that we've got that have got the higher number of reviews consistently appear above those podcasts which have higher downloads through the iTunes store but which don't have as many reviews associated with them.
Which means the whole model is completely skewed in some respect, because actually there's a difference between reviews and ratings. And it's almost like there's an extra sort of thing where if you recommend it to a friend, it boosts the rate. You know what I mean? There is so much more richness that can be done. It's almost turning the App Store into potentially into a social network, I guess. It adds the word of mouth thing and makes it intrinsic to the application store. So it effectively, you can have an application that goes viral because it's good.
But even the viral application is no certainty of performance.
No, that's true.
That's what I'm saying.
Because there, a large number of idiots could still buy it.
Yeah,
James, that's a good idea. Do they have social search yet in the iTunes store? In the App Store, I guess. I know they do with Ping now, but have they done it with apps?
What Ping's for?
Allegedly with Ping for the iTunes store, exactly. But in terms of the App Store, no, there's nothing. Apart from the approvals and rating systems.
Interesting. But you're right, James. That would be one of the that could help it more than possibly anything, is seeing what your actual real life friends think and of those apps.
But you say that, but Ping's a flop.
Yeah, it is. Ping is a flop. I just think what's so ironic about this whole conversation we're having, right, is we started off with BlackBerry and they faded away. We've now have gone on to the Apple App Store, which is kind of proving the point with BlackBerry that
it's crap.
What? Yeah. I mean, they've dragged their feet too long. And I know I said this a few months ago about that maybe there is a market for 7-inch. I don't think there is anymore. I'm going to go back on what I said and say, yeah, I was an idiot for saying that. I don't think there is. I think there's a market for maybe up to a 4.5-inch screen phone. And then after that, Apple, once again, probably has already set the market for a 10-inch tablet. That's what people want. They're used to that real estate. And anything less would be uncivilized.
I think you're right.
If it has to be made, do you buy an iPad or do you buy something else? And at the moment, there's nothing else.
This is the point, you know, is there really any genuine competition for the iPad as it stands?
No.
Well, the silly thing, the thing that is so
two absolute no's.
the thing that is so absurd about this entire concept of there being no competitor to the iPad is that it's all the same hardware. These things all run the same ARM A8 or A9 CPUs. They share many of the same graphics processors. They all run at about a gigahertz. They all have the same RAM. I mean, it's all the same capacitive touchscreen. Hardware-wise, they're as generic as your beige box PC. But the silly thing that differentiates them is that they've chosen to lock themselves off from applications, which seems to be a choice. You know, we have open development tools called the World Wide Web and HTML5 and new standards that could be formed to be universal application platforms. But for whatever reason, device lock-in, artificial differentiation, whatever it is, we have all these different beige box PCs in the form of black rectangular slates competing on with what is essentially the same hardware.
And add to that the fact that 90% of them are running OS, which is designed for a personal computer or is designed for a cell phone.
Good point.
Good point. And yeah, add one more thing on that.
They're all made in China. But as you said,
go ahead, Sarah.
I was going to say, I know we've touched on this before, Eric, but you're right. I mean, why not develop for HTML5 and then you develop for every platform?
Yeah, I thought about that. I don't know what I think that would be the best for consumers if there were if everyone just adopted this completely open standard. But I don't know. It seems so antithetical to the business models and how they sell tablets right now. I don't know what the incentive for the manufacturers would be.
I think to add to that is that I don't think anybody has fully implemented HTML5 in the, you know,
not even close.
No, and Google already gave up on it.
Yeah, and went into WebM. Yeah,
God, don't you love consumer friendly companies? Ubuntu, where are you?
Yes,
in the toilet.
Speaking of consumer friendliness, how about that AT&T, guys?
Hey. AT&T have bought T-Mobile in the US for $39 billion.
Can I just stop you, by the way, very, when you say billion, you said it exactly right. You say billion. You don't say billion. You say $1 billion.
Yeah, there's supposed to be an S on the end as well, because it's plural, of course, because 1 billion and 2 billions...
$1 billion.
39 billions.
AT&T, reach out and buy someone.
Question one, where the hell's AT&T got the money from? Because they're already in debt for what, about $70 billion, isn't it? And is T-Mobile really worth $39 billion?
Wait, why are they in debt?
AT&T are hugely in debt.
To Apple.
Yeah, they've got...
That's what I was thinking, Kyle.
They've got operating losses. Effectively over year on year. I mean, when they first took on the iPhone, they had an operating loss of $76 billion.
I wish we could all do that.
Not from what I was just reading, they were showing that they made like $40 billion in profits.
Yeah, that year. But the problem that they had was their operating loss prior to taking on iPhone was over $75 billion.
Oh, and you think they're still in the red?
I'll lay you money that they're still in the last 5 years to 10 years. I reckon they're still in the red. Yeah.
Can I ask a stupid question, please?
Go, please.
The T-Mobile that they've bought, is that just the American T-Mobile or the whole world's T-Mobile?
It's just US.
Right. Okay. I don't care.
Don't worry, James,
Deutsche Telekom.
Yeah, Deutsche Telekom are now focusing on the European market.
I
don't know what that means. Because I thought T-Mobile teamed up with Orange here.
No, I mean, T-Mobile was they purchased 1-to-1, which was the cell phone provider here in the UK, sort of 10 years ago-ish. And T-Mobile was owned by Deutsche Telekom and is huge across the whole of Europe. And then they branched out into the USA as a market. So in terms of market share in the US, I don't think they're enormous.
Uh-huh. I think only that bit of it that AT&T's bought.
They've only bought T-Mobile US for $39 billion. So
that's a ridiculous.
That's a lot of money.
Yeah, let me see. I can get you a I can get you the actual figure of their market share. T-Mobile has 11.8% share of US wireless subscribers. 11.8% to AT&T's 29.8%.
Yeah,
so combined, they would be the largest carrier in the country.
That's a lot of towers.
Well, I think
a lot of wires.
The one thing that I wrote an article a few years, 2 years ago now, that said that the iPhone was a thorn in the side of AT&T, and it was probably almost like a parasite. It was going to burrow in, grow and grow and grow, and eventually be the death of AT&T. And I could see Apple coming back to AT&T and purchasing AT&T, including all of their debt at some point, because the iPhone, whilst it was the cash cow for them, also had an enormous expenditure on their inability to supply infrastructure for it to function properly. And I'm not sure that they actually are supplying an adequate infrastructure as it stands now, which is why Verizon's capitalizing. So the move to buy T-Mobile, I'm sure, is to get infrastructure, nothing more, to get transmission bases and to get physical signal out to people at higher bit rates in more locations.
Well, that sounds like it's a good thing, like it's a positive thing for consumers. But I mean, really, it's just to lock them off, because T-Mobile, because they've been in fourth place, they've been the most innovative and some of the cause for some of the most innovative pricing models and unlimited data tiers. And a lot of people have chosen T-Mobile just because they offer the best prices by far and do put that important competitive pressure on the other guys. The biggest problem is if AT&T is allowed to buy T-Mobile, that locks up the entire GSM class of phones in the United States. Everything that is GSM would be owned by them. So they would be, they could run up the price, not only of the service, but also of the phones that you know, overseas manufacturers make that are world phones to be sold here as GSM. And most likely it would lead to Verizon purchasing Sprint to even that out and making it only a duopoly in wireless coverage.
Mm.
So you're saying it's scary about market share?
Eric, you're saying is it purely about market share?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the cost of them building out infrastructure would be nothing compared to actually... well, I mean, they published a series of slides that showed of why they're doing this and what some of the benefits. Ars Technica had a great article where they broke down the motivations and the results of all this and the statistics behind it. And one of the things they found was in their slide, they had something like average revenue per customer would increase compared to T-Mobile's, because T-Mobile operates at a smaller margin because they have to try harder to compete with the bigger guys. And the other is they reduce the rate of churn from going from phone company to phone company. So, I mean, competition is crucial here. In the same time that we hear AT&T putting 150 gigabyte caps on their DSL here, they're now, and we always hear even the FCC saying that the savior of broadband pricing is going to be wireless. Now there's going to be only two wireless broadband and wireless cell phone providers in the country. That'd be awful.
No. I think Parker Brothers is to blame for all of this. They gave us the tools many years ago called Monopoly, and they taught us how to do it, and now companies are doing it. I mean, it's not... In the UK, you guys have a huge amount of competition where it always benefits the consumer, and here we are. We always talk about in the US that it seems like, yeah, we're always saying that, yeah, there is competition, but the competition is buying up the competition. Probably in a few years again, we're going to be talking about this. The government will tear apart AT&T again, just like they did in the 1980s, and we'll be back to square one. But this always seems to have a vicious cycle. Like every 20, 25 years, We see the same thing over and over again.
It's happening in the UK. It's happening everywhere. Orange and T-Mobile, I don't think they've subsumed each other, but they've sort of they've joined forces. There are fewer service providers almost in every industry, every aspect of industry. What really annoyed me was that AT&T was sort of writing up this graphs and bullcrap kind of stuff, saying that the benefit to the customer will be greater. And actually, they're just trying to justify the monopoly in absolutely using weasel words, really.
Yep.
Absolutely.
Just like they did in 1984.
What it actually is, James, is the opposite of what they're actually saying. They're just not telling the truth.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at...
I don't like them.
AT&T's born out of Southwestern Bell, am I right?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So if you look at the acquisition of Southwestern Bell and the purchases that were done around there in the transition through to AT&T, there was huge amounts of mergers and so on, and there was an awful lot of money that was just absorbed and lost. So as an operating corporation, I don't think that AT&T has got a history of functioning as a profitable organization until recent history when it's associated with the iPhone. And the problem that it's got, I think, now is that it's looking at a diminishing income rate because of the fact that Verizon is probably the better reception and better functionality for iPhone and data across the US, and it's gone and purchased something to improve infrastructure, which is 2 years too late.
Where can we go to find out about this debt thing? Because I've never heard this, and I don't know where we can. I would like to know more about this. You say, because that concept is foreign to me, how they could buy up so many companies and make this giant monopolistic company if they're really in that much debt.
They had a lot of debt at the start when they were, and they bought Comcast Cellular as well for $1.7 billion with $1.3 billion of debt associated with it. They've bought a lot of infrastructure that was failing at the start, and I'm probably going to have to edit this podcast really heavily when I wake up in the morning, but my recollection of what went on, and it is my recollection, I've got no figures to back this up, they had an enormous amount of debt around their necks before they took on iPhone. They were not a profitable company. They were not working brilliantly, and iPhone was seen as their savior, and it has been their financial savior. But the problem is, it's created a deficit in infrastructure for them to fulfill. And the purchase of T-Mobile, I think, is to fulfill the deficit of infrastructure that they've got. And ultimately, I think it could see them get themselves in an awful lot of dire straits. I hope it doesn't, because what you guys really need over there is competition at the minute.
Yeah, absolutely. But make sure, though, that you're not confusing AT&T Wireless with AT&T Wireless, because the AT&T that we know now was it's really Singular. And then AT&T was the tiny little guy that Singular bought up and renamed themselves AT&T.
Yeah, maybe.
No, they did buy Singular. Yeah, I remember that, because there was a whole bunch. There was a lot of people.
Singular bought AT&T and then called themselves AT&T.
Yeah.
There was a huge amount.
AT&T isn't AT&T as it was.
No, AT&T is.
It's our world connected, AT&T.
Anything possible.
AT&T was Southern Bell Corporation. And then there was a huge buyout and merger with the one that I've just mentioned. I can't remember the name of. And
Singular?
No. The other one.
SBC?
Yeah, SBC was included in it, but there was another one as well as that. I've forgotten the name. I just mentioned Comcast Cellular. There we go. They bought them out as well. And there was a huge buying and merging and splitting off of several companies around the 2000 mark. It was all around that. I remember it because I was out in the States at the time that a lot of it was happening with my family. And there was press releases going on about it, but there was an awful lot of debt absorbed from those corporations as they merged as well. How much that debt was, I'm making a figure off the top of my head, but it was a significant amount. It was in the multiple billions. And whether they've got past that and created themselves a secure infrastructure going forward, I don't know, but I'm sure their 2010, 2009 statistics for their profitability and operability are superb, but there is a debt to offset from history. Whether it's enough or not is my question in my mind.
Playing catch up.
I need to sit and read up and know my figures more on that. I've talked some figures here that I thought were there or thereabouts. I think I'm right, but I need to go and find it.
Yeah, because I'm baffled here. I've always heard that they're just one of the most profitable, $80 billion a year in profits, maintain at least a duopoly in most markets and on most products. So I don't see how debt would really be an issue.
There was a period where debt was a big issue from what I understood, but I shall go back and look at my figures again, if that's the case.
I guess if the specter of acquisitions has started catching up on them, it's the case. And no matter what their turnover is, if their profit isn't enough to be able to pay off the debt, the interest is just going to sort of, it's just going to keep on going.
Mm. Sarah, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say that I just wonder, if assuming that this does go through, is it worth us having a conversation about what we think, whether Sprint might get taken over by Verizon?
Yeah, point.
Whether that's a foregone conclusion, whether it has to enable Sprint to survive.
It'd just be too...
That's seriously
sounds
bad.
Like the record industry.
Yeah, but do we think it's a serious possibility?
Heck yeah, it's a possibility. I mean, I think what we have to look at is the FCC itself. We have to look at the government itself that's actually saying, yeah, it's okay to do this stuff, and sure, the go-aheads and things, creating less competition out there. I mean,
I don't
like about the American side of business. You know, we've talked about this before on the podcast. We have this persona that, yeah, come in, start your business and do all that. But ultimately, in the end, it seems like all these big corporations just eating up all the smiles. It is. It's like the damn record industry right now. And then there were two.
I mean, I think we do need to be fair because the FCC haven't sanctioned this yet.
True.
No, and it's not going to actually finish until for another year, is it? It's going to be April next year before the whole thing's done and dusted.
Mm. Oh, money may say otherwise.
No. I mean, it's scheduled for that. They're planning for that to take that long because there's share and stock options that have got to go along that are associated with profitability. Out of the $39 billion, there is only $25 billion that's actual cash purchase. The other $14 billion is in stocks and shares that going up to a value of 8% of the total value of AT&T, I think, off the top of my head. Making it up yet again, which never stopped me before, has it? Tom in the chat room saying it's going to take a year. Thanks, Tom. If you type in AT&T debt into Google, you'll find a number of articles that are suggesting that the current static debt associated with Verizon is about $100 billion, and the current static debt associated with AT&T is around $60 billion. So I'm not a million miles off. They've recovered a little bit, obviously. It's the long-term static debt that's a problem with all of these companies. It's not the operating profits of each year. It's the fact they've got significant long-term debts through previous activities, previous failings, and previous acquisitions.
And that's debts to a bank, I'm guessing.
Yes.
That's a loan.
Oh, well. Eric's gone quiet. You're in research mode now, aren't you? Not podcast mode.
No, I'm just really confused. I mean, I don't know that much about business, and to hear that, I don't know what to make of that. I mean, I know that
Eric, give me a figure. Give me a complete BS figure of how much you earn per annum.
Per what?
Per annum, per year.
I don't know.
Pick a figure, any figure. It doesn't matter what figure is.
$10 million.
$10 million. Well done. You live in a house that costs you $100 million. Now, on $10 million a year, you can't afford $100 million house unless you save for 10 years. But you can't live homeless and earn $10 million. So you have to have a house. So where do you go?
Or to the bank, right?
Thank you. Sorry, I thought I'd lost the connection then. You go to the bank, you get a mortgage. And the mortgage is that I'll pay you back over a period of 25 years an amount which lets me give you my $10 million salary, a portion of it, so that I can own my $100 million house. Well, businesses are no different. They sit on operating losses and they sit with debts around their neck and they borrow against those debts and they borrow against their infrastructure to offset it. They have mortgages. It's the same process. And they're operating... Their operating incomes are not the necessity of their debt. They're not directly linked to their debt and their long-term debt is something which is entirely separate. But the problem is at some point, if they fail to pay back that long-term debt with the profitability that they're currently in, then they start to run the risk of going completely and utterly bump a la WorldCom and so on. They hide the profits in things where they can show high degrees of profit, but they don't actually deal with the long-term debt process behind it. And what they do is they sell off the family silver, they sell off infrastructure, they sell off accommodation, they sell off properties to keep the shareholders happy, to keep the profits up year on year on year, but they never deal with the long-term problem that's sat behind them. And that's when you get an explosive bubble behind them.
So how would buying T-Mobile help that?
Where are they going to get the money from? They've made profits in the last few years, but they're carrying, according to the stuff that I'm looking at the moment, on they may have paid some of this off, don't worry, I may be wrong, there may be old figures, but a lot of the articles are showing that there is long-term debt associated with AT&T.
Hence the financial crisis we're in now.
So is that to say that actually somebody won't honour that they're going to have to, as Eric said, they've got to get the money from somewhere, and unless somebody is idiotic enough to lend them $39 billion or whatever it is, they ain't going to get it.
You look at Apple and you see a war chest of $50 billion, etc. Now, those guys are building that war chest on $18 billion to $26 billion per quarter of hardware sales and software sales.
That's the other
sales.
Way around. That's the opposite. That's completely the other way around, the opposite end of the spectrum, isn't it? When actually they're building up an opposite. What's the opposite of debt?
No, surplus. They've got proper operating surpluses that they're storing and banking.
That's a modern industry.
That's an unheard of industry. That's why everyone is so happy with Apple, because they have so much money stashed away that they're a profitable organization who have an operating profit, which then is supported by an operating infrastructure profit behind that. Most other organizations in America don't have that issue because they're all in debt to some degree behind the scenes.
Well, I guess that's what I don't understand, because then what's the significance of I'm reading, you know, AT&T's the 13th largest company in the world. What does that mean if they're in that much debt? Does the debt matter at all? And if their only duopoly competitor, Verizon, it is in even more debt. Is that just how their industry works? They always expect to be in that kind of debt. Why are they reporting supposedly so many profits and dividends and everything?
Because that's their current operating profit, and you pay against your dividend against your operating profit. But the amount of infrastructure debt that you have behind you is still value to you. So you still own your $100 million house in the eyes of the law. So it's still an asset to draw upon. But when you become bankrupt and people, all your creditors want the money from it, then that house is withdrawn as your asset and sold off to the highest bidder that they can possibly get to pay off your debts. And none of it will be yours.
Well, so it sounds like you're saying that the telecommunications could never be profitable if we're down to two companies in the entire United States and they're in massive debt. It sounds like you're saying that it's an impossible business to even to sustain.
Until it all goes horribly wrong and the government has to bail them out because people need telecom systems.
Wait a minute. We've heard that before, haven't we? Bailout.
If you go to the AT&T website, there is a PDF document there with their current long-term debts, which I'll now post in the chat room.
Bit late for that.
Why, someone done it?
And by the way,
I did it about 10 minutes ago.
Oh, let's see if it's the same one. Yeah. It's the same one.
If anybody's
there we go.
Just tuned in, welcome to Bagel Tech Business, where we discuss debt and how it affects you.
And that is currently showing 66 $187,879,327, and that $7 could be the last $7 that they need to tip them over the edge.
Yep.
That's their current long-term debts. In order to operate a profitable business, we've had to borrow $66 billion.
Which is only actually less than twice as much as they need to get T-Mobile. So to double that, it could happen.
So they're going to go in. They're going to hit $100 billion in debt, which is where Verizon are already at, allegedly. So there you go. I said $79 billion. I was wrong. They've obviously written a little bit off it since the last time I looked at it.
Well, okay, so just to get back into the T-Mobile thing, because this is what's, I don't understand this part of the business. I mean, all I've ever heard is that AT&T is this massively profitable 13th largest company in the world that owns and operates a near monopoly, now unregulated on all the telecommunications, practically wired, wireless, broadband, TV. They're the unstoppable behemoth in the United States. So where we started down this path was, it kind of sounded, Ewan, like you were saying, you know, that's good for them for buying T-Mobile. You know, we should feel sorry for them. They need some kind of way to get out of debt. But I don't. It seems like they're like Walmart. I mean, they're giant. They're unstoppable. They're a growing monopoly again. And for you to say that, you know, that they need whatever help they can get to get out of debt just totally threw me, because I've never heard that from anywhere, and I don't understand how that plays into all this.
And not only that, they got a hell of a PR department, because, I mean...
that PDF document is dated December the 31st, 2010. As of December the 31st, 2010, AT&T are saying by their own mouth that they have a long-term debt of $66 billion.
But I have no perspective for that. I mean, do most companies operate that way?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Most people operate that way. That's why we got a financial crisis, because they all bought a house they couldn't afford.
And Ford. That's exactly right. That's why we're in the shape we're in right now. That's why governments are bailing everybody out right now. They all purchase. Hey, let's go buy T-Mobile. That sounds like a good idea. Can't afford it, but what the hell?
So I don't see how we got into this then, because if all these telcos...
Stop. Hang on, Sarah. Say again, Eric. Go on.
I don't see how we got into this then, because if the nature of telecommunications companies is to operate with some amount of debt always on your back,
it's the nature of businesses.
I'm still confused then how this came into the AT&T T-Mobile merger.
Because they're buying something they haven't got the money to buy. They're borrowing the money against a negative infrastructure. How much do you think the infrastructure of AT&T is valued at? If they're buying a business as big as T-Mobile's infrastructure business for $39 billion, I bet you that there is not many dollars left over for AT&T now with their own infrastructure to say that their own infrastructure is worth $120 billion. And if they take $39 billion of debt against that $66 billion of long-term debt they already hold, we're now at $100 billion. There's $20 billion worth of equity, if you like, in their property. Every company works this way. Every company works in debt. The only people that don't is Apple.
Apple, that's how you say, except for Apple.
Give me the most successful organization that you can think of, Eric, off the top of your head.
I don't know, but we don't have to dwell on this. But that's what confused me is if companies usually operate with debt, just like most individuals operate with some kind of mortgage or car debt, then I don't see how big, what that plays into with the merger.
How big's Walmart?
Big.
I don't know in numbers, but it's the largest company in the world.
Friggin' huge. Absolutely friggin' huge. What's their current operating long-term debt? $43 billion.
Yeah, I was going to look at this. A debt-to-equity ratio, I was just looking at, but I couldn't work out what the equity was. Just a very quick one, just to move on a little bit from the debt thing. One of the benefits of doing a merger with another company is that if you can invest a little bit of money into rationalizing all the systems, you can get rid of people, you can get rid of processes, and you can sort of, you know, get rid of the whole of the corporate business teams. And spend less money on running a larger company. So you know, it's the economies of scale. So actually, in some respects, over the course of a long period of time, AT&T will make a greater deal of profit if they've got T-Mobile's kind of infrastructure with them, because they can manage them using their own team. That's going to take a huge amount of transition and probably a substantial amount of investment to do. But long term, they're going to make even more profit because it's a larger sort of machine that's being run. And I think that's probably what was on the PowerPoint presentation, in that the cost per user will therefore be lower.
The classic example of that, James, is I know we're getting off the subject of technology, is with Lloyds TSB buying Bank of Scotland, right at the heart of the problems. They were looking at the long term thing. It put them in a whole load of pain to start with, but eventually they're going to emerge with it making so much money.
Here's the question. There's a point in the chat room here from Tom saying Google doesn't operate in debt. And if you Google long-term debt, you actually get that they're healthy and undervalued. And that's where the dot-com bubble came from, because everyone was valued based on their net assets, supposedly. But the net assets actually were undervalued against the capital asset of the corporation after it would have been broken up and sold for profit. So people were valued at a higher value than their actual corporate value was. And that's the trouble that you've got with AT&T at the moment. AT&T is stretching itself with this purchase to the point that it doesn't have capital assets perhaps to cover it. So if it goes bump, who's going to buy AT&T? Because the other thing is, now you're talking about buying AT&T with an infrastructure at $120 billion with a current operating long-term debt against them of $100 billion.
That's where you got me confused then, because you're talking like they might need some kind of government bailout. But I mean, they're a freaking revenue machine. They make gargantuan profit margins. So I don't know where this, I don't know what they're spending their money on. It's not infrastructure upgrades. It's not personnel. They're closing that down year over year.
Dancing girls and wine, dude.
Something that makes that much money every year. How could that? It's not the perception of the company that I had.
No, well, that's what it is, dude. Sorry. They currently have, by their own admission, $66 billion of long-term debt against their name that they're not paying off. And the reason is Randall wants to look good to the shareholders, otherwise they're going to sack him. So he's selling the family silver to make sure that he's got enough money to keep them happy. So he pays them out their divvies, which keeps them happy. But in paying them out their divvies, he doesn't actually settle any of the long-term debt that he's carrying along with him. We'll do a show on economics next week. It's the truth, though. It's the reason that the tech market went bump in 2000, and it's the reason that the tech market is going to have an enormous, almighty, catastrophic clash in July of this year. It is going to hit rock bottom. It is going to gravel out against the sea of despair. Because it's carrying debt, it can't sustain, it hasn't got infrastructure to cover, and when it comes to the fact that they're going to go bust, like Blockbuster, they're going to stand there and say, well, who's going to buy us? And they're going to say, well, how much do you want? And they'll go, oh, $215 million. Nah, because you got $1.9 billion worth of debt against you. I don't think so. I'll give you a dollar to absorb that, because actually what I'm going to do is break up and sell all your infrastructure, because I think I could turn it into housing and make a profit as a result after I bulldozed it. That's the only way that you make any money. Blockbuster had a huge monopoly. Blockbuster were the only people in the American high street that rented videos successfully, and they're the only people that represent them, that rent them here in the UK successfully. Everyone else has gone. All the little tiny video shops and DVD rental shops have all disappeared in the UK, and they've all disappeared in the US. Blockbuster had the monopoly. They had the high street to themselves, and they've got $1.9 billion worth of debt.
What I guess AT&T are banking on, therefore, is nothing new to come along that will replace them.
But you can't. But say that you can't replace all available spectrum. That's what I'm saying. They're not a monopoly like Apple is a monopoly, and that just that everyone happens to have bought their products and could be replaced just by a better thing coming along. They've got it locked in. They own the lines to your home. They own the phone lines. They own the cable lines. They own the lines in between, and they own the spectrum.
I mean, they're holding the US people to ransom, Eric.
And they'll say, when it comes time that they haven't got any more money because they haven't paid off the long-term debt, they'll come back and they'll say to Obama, I'm sorry, but we can't maintain a phone service unless you sort us out because we haven't got enough money. And then the US government will buy a 60% share in AT&T for $60 billion.
GM is all you got to do is look at GM, which is now Government Motors.
It's true.
That's a perfect example of that. You know, basically what a lot of companies do, they buy their way into a monopoly.
And without an infrastructure to support it, if it all goes pear-shaped, the difference is the truly long-term successful organizations have realized that actually their wealth comes from their asset and maintaining that asset. So if you look at Joe Kennedy in the 1930s, Joe Kennedy survived the Depression because he put his money into land, because everyone was going to want land. They're not making any more of it, unquote. That's where his money came. That's where he got from, because the Depression was all about extending yourself to debt potential beyond the ability to pay it off, which is where we're currently at. And the only firms that will survive an absolute catastrophic downturn in the economies in July 2011 to July 2013 is going to be the corporations who've maintained asset and those that have maintained profitability and stored long-term asset in banks, not those that have stored long-term debt with banks. And the problem that you've got is that the ones that have stored long-term debt run the risk of pulling down the ones that have stored long-term asset, because they're all in the same corporations. They're all in the same banks. They're all in the same holding pot.
You know, it doesn't really matter. Because at the end of the day, it doesn't matter. Because at the end of the day, Nostradamus said that the world will end in 2012 anyway. So screw it.
Yeah, but he was just copying off the Mayans. Sarah's lost all hope now. She's gone off because we're talking economics. But there you go. That was the economics of the tech industry, mate. That's the economics of the... Well, you've leaned back in your chair. You're done. You want a biscuit and a cup of tea.
No, I'm trying to get a word in edgeways.
Well, that's what you get for having a karaoke microphone, says James. Is it your turn to speak, Sarah? Go ahead.
Go.
All yours. Don't worry. I was just going to say that in the middle of all that, when we were talking about... how this works is it does slightly come down to the old adage that if you owe the bank $10, you've got a problem, but if you owe them $10 million, they've got a problem. And that's ultimately why they let you carry on when you are in such long-term debt, because they don't want to lose their investment.
Recovering debtor is the phrase. There we go. Exactly right.
And the title for the show,
The Recovering Debtors. Now, the best one I've got was someone who told me about cockroaches, which was a kind of similar thing. If you got 10 cockroaches, call me in. I'm an exterminator. If you got 100 cockroaches, move. On that note, we shall do the cool thingy. Have you got a cool thingy for us, James?
I do. This is a bit old school, and it's not riddled in debt, you may be happy to know. In fact, better than that, it's completely free. There was a long tradition of playing Quake 3 in LAN parties at homes, in offices at lunch breaks, and in all various different places, possibly even in coffee shops and internet cafes. There is now an online version called Quake Live, completely free to use. And if you haven't got anybody to play with and you fancy a quick sort of run around and kill people, it's available. QuakeLive.com, completely free, and brings back the old days of Quake Arena. Fantastic fun.
So it's an online game. You're not looking at sapping your CPU, etc., etc.
Absolutely, it is. It's online game. I don't know what engine it uses. I think it uses an ActiveX engine or something like that. But I've got it running on the Mac, so it must be. I don't know. It's been sanctioned by ID Software, so it is the actual Quake engine. And you're playing with people. It's really good fun.
Did you say Quake 1 or Quake 3 Arena?
It's Quake 3 Arena.
Wow. Okay,
yeah, I've played that. It ran surprisingly well in the browser, and it only reminded me what a bad shot I am in Quake 3.
Yeah, me too. It's quite depressing, but it's fun in a depressing way.
Those people move fast.
They do. they spend too long on it. That's why we have control over our lives. That's my opinion.
http://www.quakelive.com.
Brilliant fun.
Thank you, James. Sarah, have you got a cool thingy for us?
I have indeed. It's an Android app that I recently discovered that allows you to, I mean, no, it's nothing new. It has, this sort of thing's been around for a while, but it's the best one I found. It's for allowing you to look at files on your Android device. And it's called ES Files, File Explorer. And I'd simply say it does exactly what it says on the tin. I love the way you can configure it to look and feel. Apart from that, it does pretty much what it says. So it is pretty good, and it's free.
Excellent. Free we like, definitely. market.android.com/details and a whole load more, but we'll put it in the show notes. If you want to get anything that we've talked about on the show here, or any of the Mac show or the photo show, or even all the links from the Daily Show, all you've got to do is go and subscribe to the Spam, which is our weekly newsletter. Go to bageltechnews.com and type, click on the logo of the Spam and put in your email address, and that gives us the email address anonymously, so we can't check it. We can't send you spam. All we can do is send you the newsletter that you subscribe to, and that's the end of it. So,
and it's tracking safe. Cookies. Oh.
Moving on. Don't ruin my show just because I've ruined your argument. Kyle, don't tell me you're going to nominate Firefox 4 as being slick as snot.
I'm actually liking it right now, but I think I'm going to change my pick, and it's the one in the chat room right now. It's called Monopoly. It's the iPhone app. It's $2.99 in the App Store.
Because it teaches you about global economics.
It's right. My other one, though, is I actually honestly am liking Firefox 4. I know, shock. But it is a lot.
Now, why though? Slicker. Because I got to say, I all the stuff that happened a few weeks ago, you and I were in unison here that Firefox was really missing the boat.
And it was. And they've corrected a lot of things in the new one. It's a lot faster now. I'm not sure about that because we just got so used to the old layout. I guess, you know, change is good to some extent. I'm still getting used to that. But what I'm loving about it right now is I'm launching it, and it's not pulling down my system 3 seconds later after it's launched. It is pretty slick. It is pretty fast.
What about plugins?
A heck of a lot of downloads. What's that?
What about the plugins, though? Are things like Brief working and Nextmarks?
Brief is working, yeah. Yeah. I had to update Brief, but they had an update, and it's working just fine. I don't go heavy on the plugins, so that may be why I'm not seeing a lot of performance issues with the new Firefox. Mm. I'm finding it very slick. Very fast. I'm not in love with them again, but you know, I could cuddle with them for a while.
Okay, I'm surprised. I'll give it a go then. I'll rescind my previously negative opinion of them. Mozilla.org. There you go. Dead simple. Eric, have you got a cool thingy for us?
I do. So if you're a person like me who stores a lot of data, especially video, where I've got, you know, like 30 gigabyte files of shows that I want to keep an archive, you start using those little drive, they look like toasters, the little USB or FireWire drive slots where you pop in a bare hard drive, an internal hard drive, you know, SATA, and you store onto that. Well, where do you store those things and how do you keep them safe? If you see these that I'm holding up here, they look like VHS tape boxes on a shelf, or maybe more appropriately, they look like Beta SP tapes, like you'd see in a TV studio.
Right.
But they're about that size, and you store a full-size internal hard drive inside of there. And so it can be, the reason that made me think of why I thought to talk about these is I recently went through and I reorganized a bunch of my stuff and consolidated some data, put labels on these things. But I've got one not to recommend and one to recommend. The one that I have that I don't like is from a company called Weebatech. I don't know how to pronounce it. It's W-I-E-B-E Tech. And they make these, they were the first to market that I ever saw that had these kind of VHS styled tape looking boxes for internal hard drives, but they have these really annoying latches where you have to get your fingernail under them, and they're really difficult to open, and it really takes the fun and ease out of them. So I'm going to steal a theoretical pick from Alex Lindsay, who ran into the same problem independently from me with these things, but then picked this on a different show. Drive boxes from a company called Hudzee, HUDZEE.com. They are the same principle But they have a more obvious locking flap that looks like if you're popping these things in and out to do backups and swap data around and store your working files on. The Hudsy drives look like they're so much better. And I will be making a purchase with them soon, and I'll let you know how they go. The problem, though, is with either of these, they're expensive. The Hudsy drives are $5.50 each. The ones that suck are $7 each.
Right, okay.
And you can't fit them into an old VHS case then?
No, not quite.
Very good.
Because I had a lot of those laying around. Oh, well.
My pick is Clean My Mac. I know it's a Mac pick, and I should have probably done it on the Mac show, but a lot of you listen to this show as well, and I really rate it. I've had a few bad experiences. I've got one that I got a bit shirty with the other week, which I've not going to mention because for liable reasons, perhaps. But Clean My Mac works really, really well. It's great for uninstalling. I recovered about 12 gigabytes of storage on my main drive just from getting things of language files, cache files, just crap that was lying around. It really, really works. It's really, really swift. It's really, really easy. It's not huge. I think you pay $60 or something like that for 5 site licenses. I bought 5 licenses and I've got it on all of the Macs that I've got here in the house. So it's a good buy and it works really, really well. And I love them to bits. Thank you very much. Clean My Mac. It's at macpaw.com. Our last word goes to our sponsors, of course. Oh, God, we're slick here. I can't get the damn thing to work. There we go. UK.
What happened to our rants? I prepared a little micro rant.
No. You need to give me that on MP3. I'll talk about that in a sec. We'll come back to it.
Oh, okay.
UK2.net, they are the people that keep us alive. We've done 1.1 terabytes of audio so far this month, and we've still got another week to go. Without these people, we just wouldn't exist. I mean, there is nowhere on God's earth that would absorb 1.1 terabytes of audio data and not give us a significant charge. And these people do it. Every month, we use more and more and more and more data, and we take the mickey out of them to a really heavy degree, and they just say no, we're really happy, and they say we love supporting BagelTech. So please, if you listen to the network and you like listening to the network, please support them back. Go to BagelTechNews.com, click on the link to make sure that they know that we've sent you to them, and have a shop around. If you're thinking of buying a domain name, the prices are really, really good. Domain names are cheaper now than IP addresses, as we said earlier on. If you're thinking of doing e-commerce, if you want to do something hosting or anything like that, they're the people to go and check out first. And every time you buy from them through our website, you're keeping us on air as well. So it's dual purpose, and they love us to bits and we love them to bits. So please support them. UK2.net. We would be utterly and totally lost without them. Please help. BagelTech Rage. We've had a question about where BagelTech Rage has gone. It's coming back on Tuesday. It's now a people's show, though. It's your show. The first episode is going to be rants from everyone on the network. We're going to say what we think. And then what we need you to do is to put voice to microphone or put telephone to Skype line. Give us a call and leave your rant for us on MP3 or on the Skype line that we're going to offer out, and tell us what really gets your goat, what really winds you up, what's happened this week in the news that you want to have your say about. It's your show to fill. It's not ours anymore. We'll do the first one, but after that, it's down to you. We're looking for ordinary people out there, you guys and girls, to ring in and say what really gets your goat, and the Rage Show will be your chance to vent your spleen to the listening masses. And you've got a fair few listeners already who are going to join in and take that on. So send us your MP3s to bageltechrage@gmail.com, and you can have a listen there. Where can we get a hold of you, James?
SYZYGY on Twitter. That's the best thing to do. Or if you type James Hart Luton, you can see the various sites that I've been to, although I do try and clear my history if I possibly can.
Ah, good man. Sarah, where can we get a hold of you?
My website is sarahjaneuk.com, or you can get a hold of me on Twitter at sarahjaneuk.
Jolly good. Kyle, where are you, mate?
Twitter.com/KyleSwagger.
This is all very matter of fact, isn't it? You've all had enough. We're businessed out. And last, but my name is least, Mr. Eric Lanigan.
At ericlanigan.com, ericlanigan, same username on Twitter. And check out Tech Talk Back, my weekly call-in show, which I just, the new one is up on my website today. So let me know what you think of it.
9 a.m. Pacific, yeah.
Yeah, 9 a.m. Pacific, 12 to 2 Eastern on Thursdays.
Right. Don't forget, we're going to do daylight saving this week in the UK. So we should all be back to normal 8-hour separations between us and Pacific time. And Eastern Standard will be back to 5 hours after Saturday night. So everything back to normal next week.
I'm happy. Because I get to sleep in one extra hour.
You get an extra hour in bed because you don't move time, do you?
It goes the other way for you.
No, he doesn't. Like, he doesn't change time. The Philippines don't move their time at all.
Never.
There you go. Jolly good.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Okay.
Have a good week and a good weekend, and we'll see you again soon. Thanks for listening.